Practical Anarchy by Stefan Molyneux of Free Domain Radio. Practical Anarchy is the second in a three-volume series on anarchy. The first volume is Everyday Anarchy, and the third is Achieving Anarchy. Free Domain Radio is the largest and most popular philosophy show on the web and was a top 10 finalist in the 2007 Podcast Awards. Please visit us at www.freedomainradio.com. The show survives entirely on voluntary donations. If you find this book helpful in any way, please donate at Free Domain Radio. By the same author. That's me. On Truth, the Tyranny of Illusion. Universally Preferable Behavior, a Rational Proof of Secular Ethics. Real-Time Relationships, the Logic of Love. The God of Atheists, a Novel. Everyday Anarchy, available at freedomainradio.com. I would like to thank Charlotte and Greg for helping me to proofread and edit the book, as well as the wonderful Carl Bennion for supplying the beautiful cello playing that you hear in the various sections. If you would like to hear more of this wonderful music, you can visit Carl's YouTube channel at youtube.com/Carl Cello, K-A-R-L-C-E-L-L-O. Preface. Any author who gives his work away faces the unique challenge of convincing people who have not invested their money in buying it that it is worth investing their time to listen to it. Samuel Johnson once wrote, "No man but a blockhead ever wrote, except for money." Which makes my task even harder, since either Mr. Johnson was a blockhead, or I am. I do think that there are some circumstances under which releasing a work for free does not necessarily imply that it is worth exactly what readers pay for it. Those proposing radical new approaches to age-old problems, the addition of new thought to the human canon, will not find it particularly easy to get people to pay good money for such mad claims. If I am writing a book on Christianity, then I can sell it to Christians. If I am writing a book on libertarianism, then I can sell it to libertarians. If I am writing a book on politics, I can sell it to the deluded. If I am writing a book for the future, for a truly free society that is yet to be, who do I sell it to? I cannot even tell in particular detail what this new society might look like or be able to achieve, save that I am sure that they have not yet found a way to send gold backward through time and deposit it on my doorstep. Although improbable, it is not completely impossible that you might find something radical, thrilling, and new in this book, despite its cover price. The best way to spread new ideas is to make them as available and accessible as possible, which is why I give everything away and rely, not without reason, on the generosity of my readers and listeners. Despite our universal abhorrence, evils continue to plague the world without respite. We fear and hate war, yet war continues. Our souls revolt against unjust imprisonment and torture, yet such injustices continue. We feel powerless in the face of endless tax increases, and with good reason. We feel agonizing compassion for those who are caught up in the endless bloody nets of tribal conflicts, condemned to mute horror and blank-eyed starvation. The plight of the enslaved weighs down our hearts with the rusty chains of useless sympathy. We would do almost anything to free the world from such monstrous evils, yet we feel so helpless. We all want a free and wonderful world, and yet feel utterly paralyzed before these monsters who commit such universal crimes. Violence, injustice, and brutal control are truly the malignant cancers of our species. Philosophers have chided and reasoned in vain for thousands of years. Governments have been instituted to serve and protect the people, yet always escape the flimsy walls of their paper prisons and spread their choking powers across society, darkening hope and the future. In this book, I do my part to put an end to these evils. I know exactly how all these horrors can be ended. I'm fully aware of the outlandishness of this claim. I'm fully aware that you have every right to be perfectly skeptical and cynical about the contents of this book. I would not blame you at all if you laughed in my face, spat at my feet, did anything you pleased, as long as I could get you to turn just one more page. Because what if it were possible? What if it were possible to live in a world free of the terror and genocide of war? What if it were possible to live in a world without unjust imprisonment, institutionalized rape, and the endless subjugation of the helpless and arming of the vicious and evil? What if you were listening to a small blueprint that could lead to just such a world of peace and plenty, of compassion, voluntarism, virtue, and true liberty? Isn't that what we all really dream of? Isn't that the world that we wish with all our hearts that our children could inherit? Isn't that the world that we would like to take even a few steps towards? Give this book a few minutes, I beg you. We can get there. My next book, Achieving Anarchy, will show us how. Why do we examine the destination before mapping the journey? Nietzsche said, "He who has a why can bear with almost any how." Before we discuss how to get to freedom, we must know why a stateless society is so essential. This book will show you what real freedom looks like. Part 1. Methodology. Introduction. The inevitable and highly intelligent questions that arose in response to my last book, Everyday Anarchy, mostly centered on the question of how a stateless society could self-organize in practical terms. Naturally, these sorts of questions are a fascinating and endless kind of intellectual delight. Much as Alice mused as she fell down the hole at the beginning of Lewis Carroll's famous book, we intellectuals are tempted to design the future down to the last detail. We try to respond to every conceivable objection with yet another essay on how roads can be delivered in the absence of a government, or how international treaties can work in the absence of law courts, or how children can be protected in the absence of the police, or how national defense can be secured in the absence of a state army, and how the poor can receive an education in the absence of public schools, and how and why doctors will help the impoverished sick without being forced to, and so on. I have always argued that these answers, though intellectually stimulating and enjoyably debatable, will never convince those who wish to avoid the morality and practicality of nonviolent solutions to the problems of social organization. For instance, in my last book, as well as a recent video, I provided a proof for anarchy, which relied on the reality of non-contractual special interest group relationships with up-and-coming politicians. A large number of people wrote to me in response, saying either that such special interest relationships did not exist, surely a laughable proposition given the 30,000-plus lobbyists registered in Washington, D.C. alone, or that if I wanted anarchy, and democracy was a great proof of the practical functionality of anarchy, then surely I should be happy with democracy. There seems to be no end to the foolish statements that can be uttered by those afraid of the truth. The truth, as Socrates gave his life to show, remains highly threatening to entrenched interests and has a very personal and volatile effect on our immediate relationships. In reality, it is not so much a stateless society that we fear, but rather a familyless and friendless society where we rock gently, hugging our useless truths to our chests, solitary, ostracized, alone, rejected, scorned, derided. The truth is a desert island, we fear. And so, as evolutionarily social animals, we join our corrupt circles in mocking and attacking the truth, and resent those who tell us the truth, for revealing the corruption that formerly was only visible unconsciously, which is to say, largely invisible. It is important to understand, up front, that this book will contain truths that will likely be highly threatening to you, and certainly to those around you. The world, viewed philosophically, remains a series of slave camps where citizens, tax livestock, labor under the chains of illusion in the service of their masters. As I talked about in my book, Real-Time Relationships, the predations of the rulers survive on the horizontal attacks of the slaves. Because we savage each other, we remain ruled by savages. Thus, you may find that as you read this book, you experience a rising frustration and irritation with its contents, and possibly with me as well, if experience is any guide. I certainly do sympathize with these emotions and truly understand their cause, but I would strongly urge you to refrain from sending me angry emails, for your sake, not mine. It is, as you know, highly unjust to attack a truth-teller for the discomfort he causes. It's not my fault that you have been lied to your whole life long. Furthermore, the lies exist whether or not you hear the truth from me or from anyone else. Limitations. It is impossible for any single man or group of men to ever design and predict all the details of any society. In order for you to get the most out of this book, I will make a few suggestions which may be helpful. First of all, if you approach this book with the idea that you're going to find every possible gap in an argument or nook and cranny where uncertainty may reside, then this book will be a complete waste of time and will raise your blood pressure for absolutely no purpose whatsoever. When Adam Smith formulated the arguments for the free market in the late 18th century, it was not considered a requirement that he predict the stock price of IBM in 1961. He began working with a number of observable and empirical principles and proved them with rational arguments and well-known examples. The validity of the invisible hand was not dependent upon Adam Smith predicting and describing in detail the invention of, say, the internet. The methods that free men and women invent and use to solve social problems cannot reasonably be predicted in advance, and finding every conceivable fault with any and all such possible predictions is arguing against a mere theoretical possibility, which is both futile and ridiculous. That having been said, it is still worth reviewing some possible solutions to social organization that do not involve the monopolistic violence of the state. When Enlightenment thinkers attacked and undermined the exploitive illusions of religion, they were not able to provide a valid and scientific system of ethics to replace the mad moral commandments of historical superstition. It certainly is valuable to disprove existing, quote, truths. But if we do not come up with at least plausible alternatives, these falsehoods inevitably tend to morph and reemerge in a different form. Thus did the death of religion give rise to totalitarianism, just another worship of an abstract and irrational moral absolute, the state, rather than a god. The unjust aristocratic privileges of the minority that the Founding Fathers so railed against simply morphed into the unjust privileges of the majority in the form of mob-rule democracy, which then morphed back into the unjust aristocratic privileges of the minority in the form of a political ruling class. Men and societies all need rules to live by, and if existing rules get knocked down, they simply rise again in another form if rational replacements are not provided. Exposing a lie simply breeds different lies, unless the truth is also advanced. I have set myself a number of goals in the writing of this book that I wanted to mention up front, so you could understand the approach that I am taking, the strengths and weaknesses of what I am up to, as it were. First, I promise to refrain from exhausting your patience by trying to come up with every conceivable solution to every conceivable problem. Not only would this end up being grindingly boring, but it would also indicate a strange kind of intellectual insecurity, and an unwillingness to give you the respect of accepting that you can very easily think for yourself about the solutions to the problems discussed in this book. My aim is to give you a framework for thinking about these issues, rather than have you sit passively as I explicate the widest variety of solutions to all conceivable problems. In other words, my purpose in this book is to teach you to be a mathematician, not show you how good a mathematician I am. Teaching you how to solve problems is far more respectful than giving you solutions. I have always said that everyone is a genius and everyone is a philosopher. You do not need me to spell out how a stateless society can work in every detail, but rather to give you a framework which you can use to work out your own answers and satisfy yourself how well a truly free society will work. When Francis Bacon was putting forward the scientific method in the 16th century, it was not necessary for him to solve every conceivable scientific problem in order to prove the value of his methodology. It certainly was useful for him to show how his methodology had solved a number of vexing problems, and that it pointed the way to answers in a number of other areas. But, of course, if Bacon had been able to solve every conceivable scientific problem that could ever possibly arise, there would be precious little need for his scientific method at all, since we would just consult his writings whenever we had a scientific problem that we could not solve. In the same way, As a philosopher, I am interested in teaching people how to think in a new way, rather than giving them explicit answers to every conceivable problem. My approach to rational and scientific ethics, universally preferable behavior, is to provide people a framework for evaluating moral propositions, rather than to give them an utterly finalized system of ethics. If such a system of ethics ever could be developed, which seems highly unlikely given the inevitably changing conditions of life, society, and technology, then no one would ever have to think about ethics ever again, and philosophy would fall into the abyss reserved for dead religions and defunct ideologies, interesting only as yet another example of a temporary historical illusion, like the worship of Zeus or Mussolini or Paris Hilton. The scientific method certainly did, and does, provide an objective methodology for gaining valid knowledge and understanding of the physical world, just as universally preferable behavior provides an objective methodology for separating truth from falsehood when it comes to evaluating moral propositions. And the free market provides an objective methodology for determining value in the provision of goods and services through the mechanism of price. The value of the scientific method only truly becomes apparent when we abandon religious or superstitious revelation as a valid source of, quote, truth. We only refer to a compass when we become uncertain of our direction. We only begin to develop science when we start to doubt religion. We only begin to accept the validity of the free market when we doubt the ethics and practicality of coercive central planning. On a more personal level, we only begin to change our approach to relationships when we, at last, begin to suspect that we ourselves may be the source of our problems. Much like a river, alternative tributaries only arise when the original flow is blocked. The development of new paradigms in thought is, in general, more provoked than plotted, and erupts from a rising exasperation with the falsehoods of existing, quote, solutions. This spike in emotion can sometimes arise with extraordinary rapidity from a slow build to a sudden explosion. And it is my belief that this is where we are poised in the present when it comes to an examination of the use of violence in solving social problems. As a vivid, living value, the nation-state, as an object of worship and a source of practical and moral solutions, is as dead as King Tutankhamun. No one truly believes anymore that the state can solve the problems of poverty, of miseducation, of war, of ill health, of security for the aged, and so on. Governments are now viewed with extraordinary suspicion and cynicism. It is true that many people still believe that the idea of government can somehow be rescued, but there is an extraordinary level of exasperation, frustration, and anxiety with our existing methods of solving social problems. When someone says that we need yet another government program to solve all the problems created or exacerbated by previous government programs, most people now view this approach as an eye-rolling non-answer. Of course, we still hear a lot about government solutions in the media, academia, and the arts. But most people now understand, at least emotionally, that this bleating arises from special interest groups that are either threatened or protected by the state. The automatic reaction of increase regulation. When a problem arises, this demand no longer comes from the people, but rather from those parties that will benefit from increased regulation. The rise of the internet has also rocked the mainstream paradigm of government as virtue. In particular, the US-led invasion of Iraq has contributed to a final collapse in belief about the virtue of statist solutions to complex problems. It is easier to believe the lies of the past, since we were not there when they were told. It is harder to believe in the lies of the present, since we can see them unraveling before our very eyes. Thus, our belief that the government can solve problems is collapsing on two fronts. First, we now understand that the government cannot solve problems. And second, and more importantly, we can see that the government is not giving up any of its control over the problems it so obviously cannot solve. This last point is worth expanding upon, since it is so important and so often overlooked. If the government claims to take our money in order to solve the problem of poverty, for instance, but the government clearly does not solve the problem of poverty, but rather, in fact, tends to make it worse, then what do we begin to understand when the government continues to take our money? If I take your money telling you that I will ship you an iPod, what realization do you come to when I neither ship you the iPod nor return your money? Surely you understand that I only promised you the iPod in order to steal your money. In the same way, the government did not increase our taxes in order to solve the problem of poverty, but rather claimed that it wanted to solve the problem of poverty in order to increase our taxes. This is the only way to explain the basic fact that the problem of poverty has not been solved, and in fact is worse now, but the government continues to increase our taxes. We are all beginning to understand, at least at an unconscious level, that the government lies to us about helping others in order to take our money. The answer? If religion is not the answer, and the state is not the answer, then what is? Well, when a particular, quote, answer has proven so universally disastrous, the first place to look is the opposite of that answer. If no property rights, communism, is disastrous, then property rights, free markets, are most likely to be beneficial. If faith is disastrous, then science is most likely to be beneficial. If superstition is disastrous, then reason and evidence are most likely to be beneficial. If violence is disastrous, then peace and negotiation are most likely to be beneficial. If the state is disastrous, then anarchism is most likely to be beneficial. It is this last statement that tends to be the most challenging for people. Many of us can accept a world without gods and devils, without heaven and hell, without original sin and imaginary redemption. But we cannot accept, or even imagine, a world without governments. Many of us can picture a world with a minimum government, with a state concerned only with law courts, police, and the military. But we cannot picture a world without a government at all. A Christian can accept a world where 9,999 gods are ridiculous and false illusions, but that his God, the God of the Old Testament, is a true, real, and living deity. A Christian remains an atheist with regards to almost every god, but becomes an utter theist with regards to his own deity. Getting rid of almost all gods is utterly sensible. Getting rid of that one final god is utterly incomprehensible. In the same way, libertarians, objectivists, and other minarchists feel that getting rid of 99% of existing government functions is utterly moral, but getting rid of that last 1% is utterly immoral. We do not accept these reservations in other areas of our lives, which is enough to make us suspicious of the true motives behind such statements. A woman who is beaten up only once a month lives 99.99% of her life violence-free. But we would not consider her beatings acceptable on that ground. It would be even more ridiculous to say that a woman should not be beaten every day, but that it would be utterly immoral to also suggest that she should not be beaten at all. If I claim that it is moral to reduce state violence, can I claim that it is utterly immoral to eliminate such violence completely? Can I dedicate my life to reducing the incidence of cancer, but then claim that eliminating cancer completely would be utterly immoral? Can I reasonably set up a charity to reduce poverty, but then claim, in my mission statement, that the elimination of poverty would be a dire evil? Of course not. I would be viewed as an irrational lunatic at best for making such statements. Those who claim that a reduction of violence is a moral ideal, but who then also claim that the elimination of violence would be a moral evil, must at least recognize, if they wish to retain any credibility, that they are proposing an entirely foolish contradiction. Now, by violence here, I do not mean that anarchism will completely eliminate human violence. The violence that I am talking about here is the morally, quote, justified and institutionalized initiation of force that is the foundation of state power. I'm not going to go into a lengthy discussion here about the nature of the state or the moral reasoning against the initiation of violence, since I have dealt with those topics at length in my podcasts and in other books. Suffice to say that the state is, by definition, a group of individuals who claim the right to initiate the use of force against legally disarmed citizens in a specific geographical region. Thus, I think it is reasonable for us to take the approach that if it were possible to run society without a government, this would be a massive net positive. When we have governments, we inevitably get wars, politically motivated and unjust laws, the incarceration of nonviolent, quote, criminals, the overprinting of money and the resulting inflation, the enslavement of future generations through immoral deficits, the miseducation of the young, rampant vote buying, endless tax increases, arms sales around the world, unjust subsidies to specific industries, economic and practical inefficiencies of every conceivable kind, the creation of permanent underclasses through welfare and illegal immigration, vast increases in the power and violence of organized crime through restrictions on drugs, prostitution, and gambling, the list of state crimes is virtually endless. when we choose to justify governments, we inevitably choose to justify the crimes of those in power. Choosing government is also choosing war, genocide, enslavement, financial, moral, and educational corruption, propaganda, the spread of violence, and so on. You can never get one without the other. Imagining otherwise is like imagining that you can choose to justify the mafia without also justifying the violence that it uses to maintain its power. We may as well imagine that we can support the troops without simultaneously supporting the murders they commit. Given the number of bloody and genocidal crimes that orbit the power of the state, surely we can at least be open to the possibility that society can be organized far more effectively and morally without such an evil power at its center. If it turns out that society can run without a state, even haltingly, even imperfectly, then surely we should accept such practical imperfections for the sake of avoiding such rampant and bottomless crimes against humanity. Surely, even if anarchy were proven to produce fewer and worse roads, we could accept some mildly inconvenient and bumpy rides for the sake of releasing billions of people from direct or indirect enslavement to their political masters. To analogize this, imagine that someone in the 19th century proved that cotton would be 10% rougher if slavery were abolished. Would it be moral or reasonable for people to say, "Well, it is certainly true that slavery is a great evil, but I still prefer it to slightly less comfortable cotton"? No, we would view such monstrous selfishness as staggeringly corrupt. The moral hypocrisy of claiming to be against slavery, but refusing to actually oppose slavery for fear of even the mildest practical inconvenience would be an ethical evil that would be hard to comprehend. Thus, when people dismiss the possibility of anarchy out of hand by saying, "Oh, but how would roads be provided?" what they are really saying is that they support war, genocide, tax enslavement, and the incarceration and rape of the innocent, because they themselves cannot imagine how roads might be provided in the absence of violence. "People should be murdered, raped, and imprisoned because I am concerned that the roads I use might be slightly less convenient." Can anyone look at the moral horror of this statement without feeling a bottomless and existential nausea? Now, imagine that the reality of the situation is that roads will be provided far more efficiently and productively in a stateless society. If that is the case, then the practical considerations turn out to be the complete opposite of the truth. That we are accepting murder, genocide, and rape for the sake of bad roads rather than good roads. This kind of net loss provides the moral and rational core of the arguments in favor of a stateless society. While it is certainly true that some people will end up losing out under anarchy, it is the evil and corrupt who will lose the most, just as priests lose out in an atheistic society, much to the relief of children everywhere. The true reality of an anarchic society is that the moral goals of every reasonable human being, the alleviation of poverty, the provision of, quote, public services, the education of the young, the protection of children, the old, and the infirm, will actually be created and provided in a positive, productive, gentle, and moral manner. The great lie of the statist society is that the helpless and dependent are protected, when in fact they are trapped and exploited. The great lie of the statist society is that the ignorant are educated, when in fact they are made even more ignorant. The great truth of the anarchic society is that the helpless are protected, the ignorant are educated, the sick are treated, and that roads are built and are better. To gain the beauty and virtue of anarchism, we sacrifice nothing but our illusions. Surely, we should actually want to help people, rather than just pretend that we are doing so. Surely, we should not sacrifice the peace of the world to our fears of imperfect roads. The argument from Apocalypse. Of course, people do not say that we should not live in a free society because the roads might be imperfect. The endless argument against anarchism is the argument from Apocalypse, AFA. The AFA is not an argument at all, of course, but rather relies on rampant fear-mongering and an argument from intimidation. Basically, the argument goes something like this. We're all gonna die! It would actually be nice if it were slightly more sophisticated than that, but the reality is that it is not. The basic argument is that if we accept Proposition X, civilized society will collapse, children will die in the streets, the old will end up eating each other, and the world will dissolve into an endless and apocalyptic war of all against all. This is not an argument at all, since it relies on fear and intimidation. Darwin faced exactly the same objections when he first published his theory of evolution. If we accept that we are descended from apes, everybody will abandon morality, society will collapse, war of all against all, etc., etc., etc. Abolitionists faced the same argument when suggesting that slavery should be abolished. Atheists faced the same silly objections when disproving the existence of God. Philosophers have been put to death for suggesting that ethics should be based on something other than superstition. Scientists are accused of the same evils whenever some new development threatens people's existing prejudices. It is all the most rampant nonsense, which survives only because of its endless effectiveness. The AFA remains effective because of a basic logical fallacy which has doubtless been around since the dawn of speech. Belief X would result in immorality or destruction, and so only a fool or an evil man would advocate X. Since very few people wish to appear either foolish or evil, they tend to back down in the face of this argument or take the imprudent path, which I have trod many a time, of attempting to disprove the argument from Apocalypse. Anarchism results in evil, cometh the cry, and anarchists around the world endlessly respond with, no, it won't. thus losing the argument before it even begins. The only thing that is relevant to any intellectual argument is whether it is true or not. Refusing to examine the validity and consistency of a mathematical argument because you fear that accepting its conclusion will result in endless evil is simply surrendering to superstitious fear-mongering and abandoning your rationality. Propositions cannot be evil. Mathematics cannot be evil. Statism cannot be evil. Error cannot be evil. And the truth is not virtuous. A proposition cannot strangle a baby, an argument cannot rape a nun, and a theory of anarchism cannot turn people into shrunken-headed zombies in hot pursuit of Will Smith. A theory of anarchism can only be true or false, valid or invalid, logical or illogical. If someone deploys the argument from Apocalypse, it proves nothing, except that he has no good arguments, and that the proposition in front of him is emotionally unsettling in some way. In other words, all that the AFA proves is intellectual idiocy and emotional immaturity. It is the philosophical equivalent of arguing against the proposition that ice cream contains milk by saying, "I once had a dream that an ice cream monster was trying to eat me." It is the kind of non sequitur we would expect from a very young child, which would only indicate an utter incomprehension of the proposed statement. People who are threatened by ideas should at least have the honesty to say, "I am threatened by this idea," rather than pretend that the idea is somehow objectively threatening to the human race as a whole. If I am afraid of short men, I should be honest about my fears and say, "I am afraid of short men," rather than vehemently argue that short men will somehow destroy the world. However, prejudice against anarchists, much like prejudice against atheists, is one of the last remaining acceptable bigotries in the world. We cannot judge any group negatively, except a group that relies on reason, evidence, and nonviolence. Thus, it will not do us any good to run screaming from the idea of a stateless society, imagining all kinds of demonic horrors. If we allow fear-mongering to not only inform, but rather define and direct our thinking, then we are left without the ability to think at all, but must instead sit clutching the skirts of those who tell us tall and terrifying tales. We cannot judge the truth of an idea by our fears of its effect. Arguments for or against the existence of gods are not validated by our fears of or desires for a godless universe. We cannot oppose a theory of gravity by saying that it is unpleasant to fall downstairs. Neither can we oppose a new theory by demanding prior historical examples. The entire point of a new theory is that it is unprecedented. The first man to invent a jet aircraft could scarcely submit examples of jet aircraft flying in the past. Another common objection to anarchic theories is that they are not embraced or validated by professional intellectuals, philosophers, and academics. This is all very true, and as I explained in great detail in my book, Everyday Anarchy, I think we can view this as a positive rather than a negative. Still, is it reasonable for me to ask you to reject the near universal consensus of highly intelligent people, professors, pundits, columnists, academics, and so on, simply because they happen to disagree with or ignore the propositions that I'm putting forward here? Surely we have all heard of a number of scam artists, particularly on the internet, who sell snake oil solutions to genuine ailments, preying upon the weak, the desperate, and the gullible. Is it reasonable to ask everyone to completely abandon respect for scholarship and professionalism, to turf experts for the sake of their own preferred opinions? Is this not our fear of what the internet will do to social consensus? Can we not find, on the wild west of the web, internet articles claiming that smoking is good for you, that space aliens were responsible for 9/11, that exercise is dangerous, fluoride will kill you, and eating fat will make you lose weight? How can we be sure that a theory of anarchism is not just another one of these crackpot ideas that rails against the universal consensus of experts in the field, attempting to dislodge sober scholarship with wild-eyed speculation? Perhaps this book is just a form of elaborate trickery, a playing out of some wretched and buried psychological trauma designed to separate you from your friends and family by infecting you with strange and illicit ideas, and taking your money to boot, since Free Domain Radio relies on voluntary donations. Of course, these are all excellent questions to ask, and I, for one, would be highly unlikely to pit my own judgment against that of, say, my doctor or my accountant. One of the main reasons that we need specialists is because enormous swaths of human knowledge remain buried under entirely counterintuitive paradigms. Who would have thought that making your gums bleed, at least at first, with floss, would lead to oral health? Exercise often feels bad, and eating pie always feels very good. And so we need experts to remind us of the long-term effects of such activities compared to the short-term incentives and disincentives. We prefer to spend money in the moment rather than save it for a rainy day. A surgeon might make us feel very unwell in order to prevent or cure an illness that we may not even have felt yet. A friend might strive to impress upon us the emotional problems of a highly attractive sexual partner and the dark satisfactions of discharging anger towards a spouse in the present might create for us a very unpleasant future indeed. In all these areas, we rely on the objectivity and expertise of those around us, who possess the training and knowledge to steer us against our immediate desires, or who are not subject to our own immediate desires, as in the case of our friends, and so can often see things more clearly. What about the famous idea that deep study tends to lead to moderation? A little learning is a dangerous thing, it is often said, and with good reason. If we are ignorant of the effects of early childhood experiences and the long-term effects on the psychology of the personality, it is far easier to look at criminals as simply bad guys. If we are ignorant of the basic truth that history is almost always a tale told by those in power in order to justify and support their own, quote, virtue, then we shall inevitably be genuinely shocked when we come across the long-lost truths of the vanquished, or the foreign, or the dead. Thus, should we not look for moderation in our responses to complex questions? The problem of health is complex, requiring a wide variety of inputs from nutritionists, physical trainers, doctors, psychologists, and so on, most of whom will counsel a form of Aristotelian moderation. Too little exercise leads to brittle bones and flab. Too much exercise leads to injury. Too little food leads to a lack of energy. Too much food leads to excess weight. An overfocus on the desires and needs of others leads to codependency. Too little focus leads to selfish narcissism. Parents must often attempt to strike a balance between discipline and indulgence. The needs of the many must be balanced with the needs of the few, even in just the business arena. The sacrifice of our own short-term happiness for the sake of the longer-term happiness of another we love is all part and parcel of having a wise, flourishing, and positive set of personal and professional relationships. Given all this complexity, does the answer of just get rid of the government not strike us as overly simplistic? My mother used to talk about three spheres within society: business, government, and labor, and the need to find a balance between them. The endless challenge in society is finding a way to stimulate business growth, but not at the expense of labor, so that there is enough tax revenue for government to provide effective social services. This kind of juggling act strikes us as eminently mature in many ways, and recognizes that, just as there is good and bad in every individual, so there is good and bad in every group. You can find bad and corrupt people in the realm of politics, labor, and business if you want, but stretching this basic reality into an outright condemnation of any group seems explicitly prejudicial. A man who has been robbed by a Chinese acrobat would scarcely be justified in demanding that the world be utterly rid of Chinese acrobats. One swallow does not a summer make, nor do bad politicians invalidate the value of government as a whole. Furthermore, isn't it rather childish to suggest that we rid ourselves of an institution that is so open and responsive to our feedback? We live in a democracy, for heaven's sake. Why throw the baby out with the bathwater when we can get involved and change the system? If we do not like a particular company's business practices, we do not have to throw out capitalism as a whole. We can inform others about their odious practices, organize boycotts, and so on. Surely the communicative power of the internet has removed significant barriers to freedom of self-expression and the exchange of information, to the point where we no longer need to sit back when an institution fails to serve us, but rather we can very quickly and effectively work to bring about change in our political system. It also seems very alarming for us to take the enormous risk of getting rid of a government. Such a radical step has never been taken before as part of a conscious philosophical program. Governments have collapsed, of course, and we can only look at the example of Somalia to see the infighting and warlords that can arise from such a situation. And governments have been taken over, either internally or externally. But there is no example in history of consciously dismantling a state without any goal of replacing it. Does it seem sensible to go directly against the entire collective history of our species and throw out an essential human institution that has been around as long as we have? Other radical reorganizations of human society have resulted in endless slaughter, chaos, war, and the staggering disorientation of children raised without families, of rampant polygamy, communal, quote, ownership, and so on. It does seem to be a particular curse of our species that every generation or two some new idea comes along which aims to overthrow the entire history of human interaction and replace the controlled hurly-burly of a state-managed free market with something like fascism, socialism, or communism. Then some other wild-eyed rebel comes along and decries that family is dictatorship and attempts to undermine and destroy that most essential component of social life, the nuclear family. Then someone else comes along and says, property is theft, and the cycle just seems to start all over again. The basics of human society, of human life itself, seem to be that families are good, that private property is important, that the greed of the free market cannot provide all possible goods and services, that some form of centralized regulation and lawmaking seems to be essential, that there is good and bad in everyone, but there are some very good people and some very bad people, and that the good people need a government to protect them from the bad people. I confess that it must be quite exasperating for people to hear some of the basics that are so commonly accepted as truths opened up once more for a new examination. Perhaps it feels somewhat akin to a biologist being lectured to by a creationist during a long intercontinental flight, or a math teacher being cornered by a hyper-intense student strung out on caffeine who insists that numbers are just an illusion, man! Scientists do not consistently reopen the basic methodology of the scientific method. Economists are not continually overturning the essentials of their own profession, that human desires are limitless but that all resources are limited. And doctors do not continually debate the value of the Hippocratic Oath. Surely, we can say, some basic aspects of human life can be accepted as given, so that we can have a firm foundation to build our edifices of thought upon. There are certain kinds of philosophers who will continually reopen the question of metaphysics and epistemology, and demand to know how we know that we are not living in the dream of an existential demon, and that everything is a managed illusion, and that we may, in fact, be a brain in a tank in a form of matrix. These sorts of thinkers do bring up intellectually stimulating questions, to be sure. But there are very few of us who do not inevitably shrug our shoulders after failing to penetrate this veil of ignorance, and shrug off the burden of these unanswerable questions, certain that we still have a life to live in the real world, and that to sit and forever ponder these unanswerable questions would be to sink into a kind of hyper-intellectual coma. Finally, let us suppose that it would be a good thing to get rid of the government. Well, it might also be nice if we could fly, breathe underwater, and sneeze gold. An essential component of rational prioritization is to recognize and separate the possible from the impossible. It may indeed be the case that we live in the dream of a demon, but so what? What possible difference could it make to our daily life if this were or were not the case? If it is utterly impossible to get rid of the government, at least in our own lifetime, then isn't it just a kind of narcissistic self-indulgence to continue to play around with the idea as if it ever could be implemented? We could also theorize that spending a solid week in zero gravity would be an excellent cure for lung cancer, but that would scarcely help the people suffering in our own lifetime. Surely those of us with the intellectual abilities to traverse such endless abstractions should use our abilities for a more tangible and immediate good, rather than perform the intellectual equivalent of inventing the inner workings of Klingon biology. We certainly do have the right to be skeptical about those who take their intellectual powers and run off in hot pursuit of the impossible. What could possibly be their motivation? Why would anyone want to get involved in a series of ideas that can never be achieved, that are alienating and frustrating to discuss, that eject these thinkers from anywhere close to the mainstream of social thought, and which create endless awkward silences at dinner parties, sweaty-palmed avoidances in one's early dating life, endless impossibilities in educational environments, teeth-grinding frustration when reading the newspaper or watching a movie, a reputation for eccentric and strangely intense thinking patterns, habitual eye-rolling from friends, a suspicious intellectual monomania that people kinda have to steer around if they wish to avoid setting you off, and last but not least, some fairly endless challenges when it comes to raising your children and filling them full of ideas that will doubtless set them approximately one solar system's league away from their peers. It seems like an entirely generous estimate to imagine that more than 1 in 100 people will ever be interested in learning more about anarchism. And perhaps 1 out of 1,000 will avidly pursue the course of thought and become full-fledged anarchists. What are the odds that these incredibly rare creatures will just happen to be scattered around the budding anarchists' social, familial, and educational spheres? Statistically, anarchism is a surefire recipe for social and familial isolation. After the virus of anarchism infects you, the possibility of infecting others remains very low. Thus, you must either retreat to some sort of mental cave, or live a psychologically perilous form of double life, biting your tongue and averting your eyes whenever the topic of politics, economics, or the state comes up. Given all these dire social consequences, combined with the fact that anarchism will never be implemented in our lifetime, how can we possibly understand the pursuit and acceptance of these wild ideas as anything other than a kind of intellectual shell around a hyper-tender personality designed to alienate, frustrate, and drive people away, perhaps as a result of a tortuous history of parental rejection? Other than a strange and perverse kind of emotional masochism, what could conceivably motivate someone to take such a mad, vain, futile, and unachievable intellectual course? Surely, even if anarchism is sane, anarchists are not. It certainly is true that there are many strange people in this world who believe many strange things, and that some of those strange people believe in anarchism. Stalin was both an evil sociopath and an atheist. Hitler was a murderous racist who also knew how to tie his shoes. This does not tell us anything about atheists or people who know how to tie their shoes as a whole. A merely personal confession. I can say for myself, and I mean this only for myself, that although the truth often does press down like the weight of a cathedral on my sometimes sloping shoulders, and though it does lower a dark and rippled glass between myself and the companions and family of my youth, and though it startles and scatters shocked glances in the faces of those around me, and although it renders the present unstable and the future uncertain, even with all that the truth demands and imposes upon me, I would not let you tear it from my heart with any power at your command. The truth was not something that I set out to pursue. I dabbled in ideas when I was a child, just as I dabbled in playing certain instruments and painting in watercolor, never once dreaming that it would be anything other than a mildly diverting hobby. Looking back on it now, many decades later, it reminds me of one of those horror stories which depicts the disastrous consequences that result from delving too deep into the earth. Some sort of unholy beast arises from the depths and lays waste to the surface world. A beast that has lain dormant for hundreds or thousands of years is suddenly disturbed and awakes with a sky-splitting roar and a savage and unquenchable hunger for destruction. During that shock of initial eruption, when the ideas that we started out merely playing with suddenly seem to take on a life of their own, like the escalating spells of Mickey Mouse, we do recoil in horror and leap back as if laser-scoped by a trigger-happy sniper. But we quickly learn the lesson of all horror stories, which is that the monsters are never outside our head. The truth is an angry, demanding, and liberating coach who drags us kicking and screaming up a sharp and broken mountainside, and then sets us down gently to marvel in breathless wonder at the most beautiful view that can ever be conceived. As our complaints roll emptily down to disappear into the fogs of our past, in a bare ripple of white smoke, our eyes stream with tears in mute gratitude at what we have been able to behold. Such happy and driven fools often look quite mad to those around them. The truth is a drug that renders the motives of those who pursue it incomprehensible and strangely disturbing to everyone else. The ferocity of truth's beauty is utterly beyond addictive. There is a passion and almost desperation to regain and re-enter the perfection of consistent reason and the beauty of the clicking match-up between thought and observation. It keeps us awake even when we are exhausted. It strikes us with fits of passion even when we must be both silent and still. It obscures mere faces and opens up real minds. It peels away all the petty shallowness of the world and reveals all the glories and horrors of true depth. And that makes it all worth it. The pursuit of truth only seems like masochism to those who have not tasted its joys. If your personal pleasures tend to center around social acceptance, then you unconsciously know, or perhaps consciously, that the pursuit of philosophical truth and wisdom will strip away that which gives you the most happiness in the moment. In a very real sense, you are huddling at the oasis of small-minded social pleasures and cannot see beyond the desert that surrounds you to a wider and greater world. Unfortunately, there are very few philosophers who will help you to let go of this illusion. Most philosophers will talk endlessly about the beauty of the world beyond the desert, but will not confidently lead people away from the oasis they cling to. "You really should come with me," they say, "because this oasis is pretty bad, you know, and there's this wonderful world beyond the desert that we should all go to." And they tug at everyone's trousers and endlessly cajole everyone to start marching across the desert to this wonderful new world, which baffles and irritates everyone in sight. "If this new world is so wonderful and it is supposed to set you so free, then why does the sum total of your freedom appear to be nothing more than your endless insistence that we all follow you out into the desert? If our world is actually so small, petty, and unsatisfying, then why do you spend your time here rather than in this new world that gives you such endless pleasure and freedom? Because we must tell you directly that it appears to us that you are also afraid of this desert, and you do not wish to cross it alone, and so you are desperate to find people who will come with you, because you do not in fact believe in this wonderful new world of happiness and freedom. If you had cancer and you had discovered a cure for it, you would not refrain from taking that cure until you had convinced everyone else with cancer to take it. Rather, you would take the cure and document everything with as much detail as possible, so that you could better make the case to others that they should take your cure. Ah, but this is not what you are doing. You say that you have a cure for unhappiness called wisdom, but this cure seems to require that everyone else take it at the same time. You do not appear to be willing to lead by example, but instead seem to be enslaved by a compulsive need to get everyone else to take this red pill at the same time that you do. Your pursuit of wisdom has clearly not given you the freedom, happiness, and peace of mind that you claim it does, that you portray as a benefit in order to sell it to others. The world is full of people who will try to sell you cures that they do not take themselves, and there is no good reason to believe that your claim that philosophical wisdom leads to happiness is any different. This basic paradox enslaves everyone at the Oasis. The anarchist, or philosopher, it turns out, is only tortured by his vision of the world beyond the desert, and in fact is only reinforcing everyone's belief in the necessity of social conformity for the achievement and maintenance of happiness. In this way, the philosopher is actually turning everyone against the pursuit of wisdom for the sake of his own social anxieties. He is actually portraying philosophy as that which tortures you with a vision that you cannot achieve, but that you must continually harass others to pursue. Finally, since the philosopher seems utterly unable to even perceive this basic paradox, let alone solve it, how much credibility are those around him going to grant his ability to perceive, pursue, and capture the truth? If I claim to be a wonderful mathematician and go on and on about the glories of exploring numbers, but all that anyone ever sees is my continual frustration at the fact that no one else seems to be very interested in math, and my complete inability to balance my checkbook or even notice that it doesn't add up, then will I not be perceived as a kind of arrant fool, motivated by heaven knows what? The desert metaphor is somewhat limited, since when we leave the oasis and cross the desert, we pass completely out of view. However, when we pursue the truth from our love of the truth and shrug off those who do not wish to join us, we do arise as a beacon in our social world, a sort of lighthouse that can help guide the few who are capable of being seized by such a love of truth that they are willing to give up the immediate creature and social comforts of living in a world of lies. Those of us who cross the desert first can be deemed the most courageous in a way. But I must confess that, in fact, my journey felt less like a fish who braves leaving the water for the shore than a fish that is caught by the hook of philosophy and yanked unceremoniously from the depths. The future pulled me forward against my will at times, and it was with great regret that I left almost everyone behind. I was not convinced of the glories of the world beyond the desert, but rather feared that the desert would go on forever, and that actually I might go mad. Fortunately, to say the least, this did not happen, and I did discover the world beyond the desert and all the beauties and truths that it contains. By the time that my particular journey had slowed to at least a walking pace, I felt very little desire to go back to the oasis and try and get my former companions to join me in this new world. Once we have made the wrenching transition from ignorance to wisdom, we genuinely understand and appreciate the difficulty of the process, and would no more imagine dragging our former companions across this desert than we would choose a random person on the street to join us in an ascent of Everest. At the end of my last book, I talked about a small village inhabited by those of us who have made it across this desert. I believe that it is our job, if we choose it, to make this little village as hospitable and inviting as possible for those few hardy, thirsty souls that we can see struggling out of the shimmering heat of the sand dunes. Creating a place where truth is welcome is the first goal for us pioneers. We know that we cannot return to the half-life that we had before. We know that it would be selfish to continue on and on in the path of wisdom without creating some markers and resting places for those who are following us. And we know that the incredible advances in communication technology have, for the first time in history, allowed the path across the desert to be mapped and visible. Never before has it been so relatively inviting to pursue the path of truth and wisdom. The destination is no longer the Socratic cup of hemlock, or Nietzsche's madness, or Rand's later cultishness, or the dry death of academic conformity, but rather a gathering place, a forum, I would say, where we can exchange ideas and experiences and support each other and learn how to best defend ourselves against those who would do us harm and build our new homes, virtual though they may be for many, in the company of others rather than alone, which has so often been the case in the past. As we make our new homes more comfortable and inviting, we will in fact begin to draw more and more people across the desert, because they will see that there is a destination that can be achieved, and they will get more than a glimpse of the life that can be lived beyond lies. No sailor can navigate by the stars if the night is overcast or if only one star is visible. As more and more stars wink into view, the navigation becomes easier and easier. If you are tempted to pursue the freedom of truth and wisdom, or, to be more accurate, if the skyhook of truth and wisdom snatches you into some unsuspected stratosphere, then the choice has, to some degree, been made for you. To hang suspended between the worlds of conformity and wisdom is to live in a kind of null zone where you gain neither the satisfactions of conformity nor the joys of wisdom. It can be truly hard to leave those behind who cannot or will not join you on this journey. And the only consolation that I've been able to offer myself, and which I offer to you now, is that there could be nothing better to do with our lives than to create a world where we do not have to choose between wisdom and companions, between virtue and society, where a unity with truth will not mean a disunity with those around us. A few principles. Rather than repeat them every time I make an argument, I wanted to put a few principles out up front before we begin. First and foremost, although I am an anarchist, I am not a utopian. There is no social system which will utterly eliminate evil. In a stateless society, there will still be rape, murder, theft, and abuse. To be fair, just, and reasonable, we must compare a stateless society not to some standard of otherworldly perfection, but rather to the world as it already is. The moral argument for a stateless society includes the reality that it will eliminate a large amount of institutionalized violence and abuse, not that it will result in a perfectly peaceful world, which of course is impossible. Anarchy can be viewed as a cure for cancer and heart disease, not a prescription for endlessly perfect health. It would be unreasonable to oppose a cure for cancer, because such a cure did not eliminate all other possible diseases. In the same way, we cannot reasonably oppose a stateless society because some people are bad and a free society will not make them good. Secondly, I am not proposing any Manichaean view of human nature in this book. I do not believe that human beings are either innately good or innately evil. I take a very conservative and majority view, which is that human beings respond to incentives, which also happens to be the basis for the discipline of economics. Human beings are not innately corrupt, but they will inevitably be corrupted by power. Most people will respond to situations and circumstances in a way that maximizes their advantage. Not explicitly at the expense of others, although that can happen, of course. But we are biological as well as moral beings, and there are very few people who will sacrifice the safety and security of their family in order to follow some abstract moral principle. When human beings are forced to choose between virtue and necessity, they will, in general, choose necessity, and will then rework their definition of virtue to justify their own actions. That having been said, it seems very clear that human beings are driven, to a very large and deep degree, by virtue. A man can almost never be convinced to do what he defines as evil. But if that evil can be redefined as a good, men will almost inevitably praise or perform it. Very few men would agree to murder for payment. But very few men will condemn soldiers as murderers. Very few people would openly say that they oppose rape but support the rapists. However, when the same moral equation is redefined as a good, just about everyone says that they oppose war but support the troops. This is one of the lessons that I explicitly take from our existing ruling class, which is that the power of propaganda to redefine evil as good is a fundamental mechanism for controlling people and making them do what you want. Before any government can truly expand, it first needs to take control of the money supply in order to bribe citizens, and the educational system in order to indoctrinate children. A large percentage of the army's communications budget is dedicated to propaganda, and I assume that these people know more than a little about how to best spend money to control the minds of others. Thus, I do understand that the reason that the debate about a stateless society is so volatile and aggressive is because anarchists are fundamentally attempting to reclaim the definition of virtue in society. And since society, as a collective, is largely defined by generally accepted definitions of virtue, the anarchist approach to ethics is an attempt to fundamentally rewrite society as a whole. Prior attempts to do this have almost always resulted in disaster, because they have always relied on gaining control of the government and using its power to impose some new version of ethics on a disarmed citizenry. The anarchist approach is particularly unsettling because we say that initiating violence to solve social problems is a great evil, perhaps the greatest evil. And so we steadfastly reject and refuse political solutions. In the current world of governments, not only is political violence used to solve ethical problems, but also the use of such violence is itself considered virtuous and wise. Thus, anarchists are entirely above the existing debate, because we are not trying to grab the gun and point it in the direction that we approve of, but rather are pointing out that violence cannot be used to achieve a positive good within society. Thus, not only are existing solutions immoral, but the entire methodology for solving problems is based on a moral evil, the initiation of the use of force. This is a fundamental rewrite of society, and people are right to be concerned and skeptical about the anarchist approach. It is the most fundamental transition that can be imagined. It is the difference between asking how slaves can be treated better and stating that slavery is an irredeemable moral evil. It is the difference between asking what transgressions children should be beaten for and stating that beating children is always and forever immoral. Using the past to justify the future. An objection to anarchism that I hear fairly often is that human beings are not so constituted as to be able to productively and intelligently rule themselves. This objection rests on such a fundamental error that it is worth dealing with upfront, since it will show up time and again in the upcoming arguments for anarchism. We can all understand that it would be completely irrational to say that slaves cannot be freed because they lack initiative and education. We all perfectly understand that slaves are barred from education and punished for taking initiative. It is like saying that a totalitarian economy cannot be privatized because all of the workers are lazy. It is clear that this, quote, laziness, actually arises out of a totalitarian economy, rather than any innate habits of the workers. Nutritionists might as well say that fat people cannot lose weight because they are fat. The entire purpose of an expert is to help undo the habits that ignorance and a lack of opportunity has bred, and substitute more rational and positive behaviors in their place. It is certainly true that people who come out of a statist educational system tend to be functionally retarded in many ways. They do not understand law. They do not understand politics. They do not understand economics. They do not understand philosophy. They very likely have never taken a course in logic or even been offered one. They do not understand the scientific method, and they fundamentally do not know how to think or debate from first principles. These are just the natural and disgusting results of the existing system. To say that men cannot be free because they lack the habits that freedom would have inculcated is a completely circular argument. It is like saying that the newborn chicks of geese that have had their wings clipped can never fly, or that the daughter of a Chinese woman who suffered through foot binding will be born with bound feet. Rejecting the virtues of the future for the sake of the evils of the past creates a closed-loop system that we can never escape. When anarchism comes to pass, there will doubtless be challenging and wrenching transitions for many people. But so what? This is actually an argument for anarchism rather than against it. The harder that it is to transition out of a violent statist society, the more it is necessary to do so and to prevent it from ever re-emerging again. We do not say that heroin is less dangerous because it is so hard to quit or so addictive. This is a central reason why heroin should not be taken in the first place. Constantly increasing our dosage of heroin because it is hard to quit would scarcely be a rational response to the problem of deadly addiction. The harder it is to quit, the more we should try to quit it, and the more we should strive to avoid re-addiction. You are not the only kind person on the planet. Another point that I would like to make up front is that there always seems to be a strange disconnect or isolation in people's concerns about the helpless and dependent in society. For instance, whenever I talk about getting rid of public schools, the response inevitably comes back, automatically it would seem, just like any other good propaganda, that it would be terrible because poor children would not be educated. There is a strange kind of unthinking narcissism in this response, which always irritates me, much though I understand it. First of all, it is rather insulting to be told that you are trying to design a system that would deny education to poor children. To be placed into the general category of yuppie capitalist scum is never particularly ennobling. A person will raise this objection with an absolutely straight face, as if he is the only person in the world who cares about the education of poor children. I know that this is the result of pure indoctrination, because it is so illogical. If we accept the premise that very few people care about the education of the poor, then we should be utterly opposed to majority rule democracy, for the obvious reason that if only a tiny minority of people care about the education of the poor, then there will never be enough of them to influence a democracy, and thus the poor will never be educated. However, those who approve of democracy and accept that democracy will provide the poor with education inevitably accept that a significant majority of people care enough about the poor to agitate for a political solution and pay the taxes that fund public education. Thus, any Democrat who cares about the poor automatically accepts the reality that a significant majority of people are both willing and able to help and fund the education of the poor. If people are willing to agitate for and pay the taxes to support a state-run solution to the problem of education, then the state solution is a mere reflection of their desires and willingness to sacrifice their own self-interest for the sake of educating the poor. If I pay for a cure for an ailment that I have, and I find out that that cure actually makes me worse, do I give up on trying to find a cure? Of course not. It was my desire to find a cure that drove me to the false solution in the first place. When I accept that that solution is false, I am then free to pursue another solution. In fact, until I accept that my first, quote, cure actually makes me worse, I will continue to waste my time and resources. The democratic, quote, solution to the problem of educating the poor is the existence of public schools. If we get rid of that solution, then the majority's desire to help educate the poor will simply take on another form. And a far more effective form, that much is guaranteed. Ah, say the Democrats, but without being forced to pay for public schools, no one will surrender the money to voluntarily fund the education of poor children. Well, this is only an admission that democracy is a complete and total lie. That public schools do not represent the will of the majority, but rather the whims of a violent minority. Thus, votes do not matter at all and are not counted and do not influence public policy in the least. And thus, we should get rid of this ridiculous overhead of democracy and get right back to a good old Platonic system of minority dictatorship. This proposal, of course, is greeted with outright horror and protestations that democracy must be kept because it is the best system, because public policy does reflect the will of the majority. In which case, we need have no fear that the poor will not be educated in a free society, since the majority of people very much want that to happen anyway. Exactly the same argument applies to a large number of other statist, quote, solutions to existing problems, such as old age pensions, unemployment insurance, health care for the impoverished, welfare, and so on. If these state programs represent the desires and will of the majority, then removing the government will not remove the reality of this kind of charity, since government policies reflect the majority's existing desire to help these people. If these programs do not represent the desires and will of the majority, then democracy is a complete lie. And we should stop interfering with our leaders' universal benevolence with our distracting and wasteful, quote, voting. We will get into this in more detail as we go forward, but I wanted to put the argument out up front, just to address the ridiculous objection that removing a democratic state also removes the benevolence that drives its policies. A fundamental anarchic argument is that a democratic state uses the genuine benevolence of the majority to expand its own power and exacerbates poverty, ignorance, and sickness in order to justify and continue the expansion of that power. This is not the first time that the benevolence of good people has been used to control them. We only need to think of the example of organized religion to understand that. One final point, and then we shall begin really rolling up our sleeves and having some fun figuring out how a free society can truly work. Although the ideas of anarchy can be alarming, it is important to remember that anarchy is not an untried and untested system. As I talked about in my last book, anarchy is the foundation of how we organize our own personal lives, and it is also the root of how the government manages to survive, for at least as long as it does, despite its corrupt and evil nature. Prior approaches to rewriting social ethics failed because they did not evolve out of what works in our personal lives. We fully accept that theories of physics cannot contradict that which is directly observable within our own lives. That which describes a falling planet cannot contradict our direct perception of a falling brick. Indeed, since we would so strenuously resist the incursion of state power into our own personal and practical, quote, anarchy, it can be easier to understand how statism is a violent and artificial solution, not anarchy. If we look at something like communism, we can see that it represented a radical reversal of what actually works in our own personal lives. We retain and trade property constantly in our own lives. Stripping us of the right to own and trade property is an entirely artificial, oppositional solution, which is why it had to be imposed through endless violence, murder, and imprisonment. In the same way, when we look at something like religion, we can see that it represents a radical reversal of what we actually believe to be true in our own personal lives. Children do not need threats, bribes, and propaganda to believe that the sun will rise tomorrow, that gravity works and concrete is hard on the knees. They do not need to be bullied in order to learn language or grow physically and mentally or ask endless questions and explore their environment. However, to believe that some ancient and fantastical Jewish zombie died for their, quote, sins, and that they are trailed and judged by an omnipresent and invisible ghost, and that they need to eat and drink symbolic flesh and blood to commune with some universal and incorporeal mind, well, that takes an enormous amount of propaganda, bribery, and bullying. Religion is an entirely artificial, oppositional solution to the question of existence and ethics. It must be repetitively and aggressively inflicted on children, because it scarcely comes naturally to them at all. Anarchy, however, does not fall into this category. For instance, when you face a problem at work, I can't imagine that you would ever sit your team down and say, I've come up with the perfect solution to our problem. What we're going to do, see, is pick two of us, give them guns, and then those two are going to force the rest of us to do whatever they want for the next few years. And then we're going to perhaps pick two other people who will get those guns, and then they'll be able to force us to do whatever they want us to do for the next few years. And then we'll start all over again. I have yet to see a business book with anything close to the title of Creating a Violent Internal Monopoly to Solve Your Customer Service Woes. In the same way, if you face problems in your relationship, you may go to a marriage counselor, but I have never heard of any couple going to the mafia and saying, "We can't quite agree on how we should be spending our money, so we're going to buy you guys a bunch of guns and bombs, and we want you to tell us what to do, and if we disobey your orders, we want you to kidnap us and throw us in some dank and horrible cell where we can only hope to be raped by other people." If you're looking for a job, I don't imagine that you will kidnap someone and force him to hire you. If you want a girlfriend or a boyfriend, I cannot believe that you will chloroform and kidnap someone you were attracted to, like the protagonist in John Fowles's The Collector. If you are having trouble parenting, it does not seem at all likely that you will hire someone to kidnap you if you parent in a way that he disagrees with for some reason. This list can, of course, go on and on, but the basic reality is that we never look for statist solutions to problems that we face in our own lives. We never create a localized monopoly, arm it, and give it the right to take half our income at gunpoint, and then force us to obey its whims. Statism and isolation. There is something about statism, some aspect of it, which profoundly isolates us from our fellow citizens. We turn from animated problem solvers to mindless defenders of the status quo. As an example, I offer up the inevitable response I receive when I provide an anarchic solution to an existing state function. When I say that theoretical entities called dispute resolution organizations, DROs, could enforce contracts and protect property, the immediate response is that these DROs will inevitably evolve into a single monopoly that will end up recreating the state that they were originally supposed to replace. Or, when I talk about private roads, I inevitably hear the argument that someone could just build a road in a ring around your land and charge you $1 million every time you wanted to cross it. Or, when I talk about private defense agencies that can be used to protect a geographical region from invasion, I am promptly informed that these private agencies will simply turn their guns on their subscribers, take them over, and create a new state. Or, when I discuss the power of economic ostracism as a tool for maintaining order and conformity to basic social and economic rules, I am immediately told that people will be marked for exclusion unless they pay hefty bribes to whatever agencies control such information. It is the same story over and over. An anarchic solution is provided, and an immediate disastrous scenario is put forward without thought, without reflection, and without curiosity. Of course, I'm not bothered by the fact that people are critical of a new and volatile theory. I think that is an essential process for any new idea. What does concern me is the fundamental lack of reciprocity in the minds of the people who thoughtlessly reject creative solutions to trenchant problems. I don't mean reciprocity with regards to me, although that is surely lacking as well, but rather with regards to any form of authority or influence in general. For instance, if people in a geographical region want to contract with an agency or group of agencies for the sake of collective defense, What is the greatest fear that will be first and foremost in their minds? Naturally, it will be that some defense agency will take their money, buy a bunch of weapons, and promptly enslave them. How does a free society solve this problem? Well, if there is a market need or demand for collective defense, a number of firms will vie for the business, since it will be so lucrative in the long run. The economic efficiency of having a majority of subscribers would drive the price of such defense down. However, the more people that you enroll in such a contract, the greater everyone's fear will be that this defense agency will attempt to become a government of some kind. Thus, no entrepreneur will be able to sell this service in the most economically efficient manner if he does not directly and credibly address the fear that he will attempt to create a new government. We're so used to being on the one-sided receiving end of dictatorial edicts from those in power, whether they are parents or teachers or government officials, that the very idea that someone is going to have to woo our trust is almost incomprehensible. If I am afraid of something that someone wants to sell me, then it is up to that person to calm my fears if he wants my business. This is so far from our existing ways of dealing with statist authority that we might as well be inventing a new planet. It is so important to understand that when we are talking about a free society, and I will tell you later how this habit is so essential for your happiness, even if anarchism never comes to pass, we are essentially talking about two sides of a negotiation table. When it comes to government as it is, and all that government ever could be, we are never really talking about two sides of the table. You get a letter in the mail informing you that your property taxes are going to increase 5%. There is no negotiation, no one offers you an alternative, your opinion is not consulted beforehand, and your approval is not required afterwards. Because if you do not pay the increased tax, you will, after a fairly lengthy sequence of letters and phone calls, end up without a house. It is certainly true that your local cable company may also send you a notice that they're going to increase their charges by 5%. But that is still a negotiation. You can switch to satellite, or give up on cable and rent DVDs of movies or television shows, or reduce some of the extra features that you have, or just decide to get rid of your television and read and talk instead. None of these options are available with the government. With the government, you either pay them, give up your house, go to jail, or move to some other country where the exact same process will start all over again. Can you imagine getting this letter from your cable company? Dear valued customer, your cable bill is now increasing 5% per month. You cannot cancel your cable. Ever. You cannot reduce your bill in any way. If you turn off your cable, your bill will remain exactly the same. If you rip your cable out of the wall, your bill will remain exactly the same, with the exception that we will charge you for the damage. Your children will be unable to cancel your cable contract. Also, please note that we will be reducing our delivery of channels by approximately one every month. As we deliver fewer channels, you can anticipate that your bill will sharply increase. If you do not pay your bill on time, the ownership of your house will revert to us, and we will lock you in an undisclosed location where you will be forced to do tech support and where we will be unable to protect you from assault and rape. If you attempt to defend yourself when we come to take your house, we are fully authorized to gun you down. Sincerely, the Statist Cable Company. We would consider this kind of letter to be utterly criminal, and we would be outraged at the dictatorial one-sidedness of the letter, as well as the threats of violence it contained. Unfortunately, this is exactly the kind of communication that we get from our governments all the time. And in many ways, it is not unrelated to the kind of non-negotiated dictums that we received from our teachers when we were children. Thus, when a philosopher of anarchy proposes private solutions to public services, we automatically and almost unconsciously feel that we are back on the receiving end of one-sided and dictatorial commandments, and fear this multiplicity of small quasi-governments, and imagine that instead of receiving a few such ugly letters a year, we shall perhaps get dozens per month. However, if you do not understand that anarchism is always and forever a two-sided negotiation, then you will remain forever untempted by its rational and empirical pleasures, and continue to confuse coercion with voluntarism, which is about the most fundamental error that can be made in moral understanding. If you feel the need for collective defense, but you are afraid that whoever you contract with for such defense will end up ruling over you, you can just sit back, put your feet up on the desk, clasp your hands behind your head, and just see who comes along with an offer that satisfies you. Once you grasp this fundamental shift in thinking, in understanding, then you can flip over to the other side of the table and use your real creative mojo to start solving the problem. In this way, you can ask yourself, if I really wanted to sell collective defense services to a group, how could I best address and alleviate their fears that I would turn into some kind of local dictator? What do you think? If you could personally make $10 million a year by solving this problem, what would you come up with? How would you address and alleviate people's fears that you would take their money, go buy an army, and rule over them? There are as many creative and productive answers as there are people interested in the problem. Here's one that occurs to me just off the top of my head. I would deposit $5 million in a third-party bank account and offer it as free payment to anyone who could prove that I was not fulfilling my contract with my customers to the letter. I would publish my accounts and inventory as widely as possible and give free access to anyone who wanted to come by and inspect my business and its holdings. In this way, people could rest assured that I was not amassing some secret army of black helicopters and men in robot suits. Ah, you may say, but what if no one wanted to come forward and perform these kinds of inspections? Again, that is easy to solve. I would just pay an organization $1 million a year to audit my business and promise them that if they ever found me accumulating any kind of secret army or weaponry, then I would pay them the $5 million in the third-party bank account. In this way, external audits would be certain to be performed, and those auditors would have every incentive to turn over every filing cabinet in search of a miniature robot army. Ah, you may say, but what if you were secretly paying this auditing organization $2 million a year to only pretend to audit your business? Well, here we are starting to get into some very strange economic territory, which would be utterly unsustainable in a free market, because my company would then be out $5 million up front, be paying $1 million for an auditing company, and then a further $2 million to produce fake audits. Such a company would never be able to offer competitive rates relative to a company that operated on the up and up. But even if this were possible, it would still be an easy problem to solve. By simply paying 5 companies to perform audits if necessary, paying $5 million a year out of a profit of $10 million a year still leaves you $5 million ahead. Ah, but what if... We all know that this game can go on for forever and a day. The mindset that I strongly urge you to try and get yourself into, however, is that you do not have to contract with anyone who is not willing to satisfy your desires. Relative risk. What happens if no entrepreneur is able to offer you a deal that successfully calms your fears? Why, then you do not have to take any deal at all. Ah, you may say, but then I'm leaving myself open to the risk of foreign invasion. Well, that is very true. But clearly, if you reject all offers from entrepreneurs who want to protect you, because you feel that their protection carries too much risk, then clearly you prefer the risk of invasion to the risk of protection. With that in mind, you may well choose one entrepreneur's scheme, not because it is risk-free, but rather because it is less risky than the risk of invasion. If you wish to be presented with a risk-free choice, then unfortunately you wish to be presented with a different kind of universe than the one we inhabit, since risk is an inevitable and natural part of life. With that in mind, let us turn to one of the first great objections to the idea of a stateless society, which is collective defense, to provide an example of the methodologies we will use in this book. Collective defense, an example of methodology. Ideally, invasions should be prevented rather than repelled, just as illnesses should be prevented rather than cured. The strongest conceivable case for anarchism is that a stateless society would, by its very nature, prevent invasion rather than merely possess the ability to violently repel it. So first, before we figure out how to repel an invasion, let us look at what an invasion is actually designed to achieve. Why invade? Let us imagine a land where there are two farms, owned by Bob and Jim, respectively. Bob is a rapacious and nasty fellow who wishes to expand his farm and make more money. To the east of Bob is Jim's farm, which is tidy, efficient, and productive, with a wide variety of cows and chickens and neatly planted fields. To the west of Bob is an untamed wilderness full of bears and wolves and coyotes and mosquitoes and swamps and all other sorts of unpleasant and dangerous things. From the standpoint of mere practical considerations, how can Bob most efficiently expand his farm and increase his income? Surely it would be to invest in a few guns, head east, and take over Jim's farm. For a very small investment, Bob ends up with a functioning and productive farm, ready to provide him with milk, eggs, and crops. On the other hand, Bob could choose to go west, into the untamed wilderness, and try to cull a number of dangerous predators, drain the swamps, hack down and uproot all of the embedded trees and bushes. After a year or two of back-breaking labor, he may have carved out a few additional acres for himself, an investment that would scarcely seem worth it. If Bob wants to expand and cares little about ethics, he will invade Jim's farm and take it over, because he will be taking command of an already existing system of exploitation and production. Thus, we can see that the act of invading a neighboring territory is primarily motivated by the desire to take over an existing productive system. If that productive system is not in place, then the motivation for invasion evaporates. A car thief will never steal a rusted old jalopy that is sitting up on bricks in an abandoned lot, but rather will attempt to steal a car that is in good condition. This analysis of the costs and benefits of invasion is essential to understanding how a stateless society actually works to prevent invasion, rather than merely repel it. When one country invades another country, the primary goal is to take over the existing system of government and thus collect the taxes from the existing citizens. In the same way that Bob will only invade Jim's farm in order to take over his domesticated animals, one government will only invade another country in order to take over the government of that country and so become the new tax collector. If no tax collection system is in place, then there is no productive resource for the invading country to take over. Furthermore, to take a silly example, we can easily understand that Bob will only invade Jim's farm if he knows that Jim's cows and chickens are not armed and dangerous. To adjust the metaphor a little closer to reality, imagine that Jim has a number of workers on his farm who are all ex-military, well-armed, and will fight to the death to protect that farm. The disincentive for invasion thus becomes considerably stronger. In the same way, domestic governments generally keep their citizens relatively disarmed in order to more effectively tax them, just as farmers clip the wings of their geese and chickens in order to more efficiently collect their eggs and meat. Thus, the cost-benefit analysis of invasion only comes out on the plus side if the benefits are clear and easy to attain, an existing tax collection system, and if the costs of invasion are relatively small, a largely disarmed citizenry. In a very real sense, therefore, a stateless society cannot be invaded, because there is really nothing to invade. There are no government buildings to inhabit, no existing government to displace, no tax collection system in place to take over and profit from. And furthermore, there is no clear certainty about the degree of armaments that each citizen possesses. Don't worry, we'll get into gun control later. An invading country can be very certain that if it breaks through another government's military defenses, it will not then face any significant resistance from the existing citizenry. A statist society can be considered akin to an egg. If you break through the shell, there is no second line of defense inside. Invading governments are well aware of the existing laws against the proliferation of weapons in the country they are invading. Thus, they are guaranteed to be facing a virtually disarmed citizenry, as long as they can break through the military defenses. Invading anarchy. Let us imagine that France becomes a stateless society, but that Germany and Poland do not. Let us go with the cliché and imagine that Germany has a strong desire to expand militarily. The German leader then looks at a map and tries to figure out whether he should go east into Poland or west into France. If he goes east into Poland, then he will, if he can break through the Polish military defenses, be able to feast upon the existing tax base and face an almost completely disarmed citizenry. He will be able to use the existing Polish tax collectors and tax collection system to enrich his own government, because the Poles are already controlled and domesticated, so to speak. In other words, he only has one enemy to overcome and destroy, which is the Polish government's military. If he can overcome that single line of defense, he gains control over billions of dollars of existing tax revenues every single year, and a ready-made army and its equipment. On the other hand, if he thinks of going west into France, he faces some daunting obstacles indeed. There are no particular laws about the domestic ownership of weapons in a stateless society, so he has no idea whatsoever which citizens have which weapons, and he certainly cannot count on having a legally disarmed citizenry to prey on after defeating a single army. Secondly, Let us say that his army rolls across the border into France. What is their objective? If France still had a government, then clearly his goal would be to take Paris, displace the existing government, and take over the existing tax collection system. However, where is his army supposed to go once it crosses the border? There is no capital in a stateless society, no seat of government, no existing system of tax collection and citizen control, no centralized authority that can be seized and taken over. In the above example of the two farms and the wilderness, this is the equivalent not of Bob taking over Jim's farm, but rather of Bob heading into the wilderness and facing coyotes, bears, swamps, and mosquitoes. There is no single enemy, no existing resources to take over, and nothing in particular to seize. But let us say that the German leadership is completely retarded and decides to head west into France anyway. And let us also suppose, to make the case as strong as possible, that everyone in France has decided to forego any kind of collective self-defense. What is the German army going to do in France? Are they going to go door to door, knocking on people's houses and demanding their silverware? Even if this were possible and actually achieved, all that would happen is that the silverware would be shipped back to Germany, thus putting German silverware manufacturers out of business. When German manufacturers go out of business, they lay people off, thus destroying tax revenue for the German government. The German army cannot reasonably ship French houses to Germany. Perhaps they will seize French cars and French electronics and ship them to Germany instead. And what is the German government supposed to do with thousands of French cars and iPods? Are they supposed to sell these objects to their own citizens at vastly reduced prices? I imagine that certain German citizens would be relatively happy with that, but again, all that would happen is that German manufacturers of cars and electronics would be put out of business, thus again sharply reducing the German government's tax income, resulting in a net loss. Furthermore, by destroying domestic industries for the sake of a one-time transfer of French goods, the German government would be crippling its own future income, since domestic manufacturing represents a permanent source of tax revenue. This would be a perfect example of killing the goose that lays the golden egg. Well, perhaps what the German government could do is seize French citizens and ship them to Germany as slave labor. What would be the result of that? Unfortunately, this would not work either, at least not for long, because slave labor cannot be taxed, and slave labor would displace existing German labor, which is taxable. Thus again, the German government would be permanently reducing its own income, which it would not do. Another reason that Germany might invade another country would be to seize control of the wealth of the government, the ability to print money, and the ownership of a large amount of physical assets, such as buildings, cars, gold, manufacturing plants, and so on. However, nothing remains unowned in a stateless society, except that which has no value or cannot be owned, such as air. There are no public assets to seize, and there are no state-owned printing presses which can be used to create currency and thus transfer capital to Germany. There are no endless vaults of government gold to rob, no single aggregation of military assets to seize. Furthermore, if we go up to a thief and say to him, "Do you want to rob a house?" What is his first question likely to be? "Hell, I don't know. What's in it?" A thief will always want to know the benefits of robbing a house. He is fully aware of the risks and costs, of course, and must weigh them against the rewards. He will never scale up the outside of some public housing welfare tenement in order to snag an old television at a tape deck. The more knowledgeable he is of the value of a home's contents, the better he is able to assess the value of breaking into it. The German leadership, when deciding which country to invade, will know down to almost the last dollar the tax revenues being collected by the Polish government, as well as the value of the public assets they will seize if they invade. The payoff can be very easily assessed. On the other hand, if they look west, into the French stateless society, how will they know what they are actually going to get? There are no published figures for the net wealth of the society as a whole. There is no tax revenue to collect. There are no public assets which can be easily valued ahead of time. There is no way to judge the cost-effectiveness of the invasion. Invading a statist society is like grabbing the cages of a large number of trapped chickens. You get all of the eggs in perpetuity. Invading a stateless society is like taking a sprint at a flock of seagulls. All they do is scatter, and you get nothing except perhaps some crap on your forehead. Thus, it is completely impossible that the German leadership would think it a good idea to head west into France rather than east into Poland. We could leave the case here and be perfectly satisfied in our responses, but I am always willing to go the extra mile and accept the worst conceivable case. Let us say that some mad German who was beaten with bagfuls of French textbooks when he was a child ends up running the government and cares nothing at all about the costs and benefits of invading France, but rather just wishes to take it over in order to, I don't know, burn all the textbooks or something like that. We will get into the nature and content of private agencies in the next chapter, but let us just say that there are a number of these private defense agencies that are paid to defend France against just such an invading madman. Well, if I were setting up some sort of private military defense agency, the first thing I would do is try to figure out how I could most effectively protect my subscribers for the least possible cost. The first thing that I would note is that nuclear weapons have been the single most effective deterrent to invasion that has ever been invented. Not one single nuclear power has ever been invaded or threatened with invasion. And so in a very real sense, there is no bigger bang for the buck in terms of defense than a few well-placed nuclear weapons. If we assume that 1 million subscribers are willing to pay for a few nuclear weapons as a deterrent to invasion, and that those nuclear weapons cost about $30 million to purchase and maintain every year, then we are talking about $30 a year per subscriber, or less than a dime a day. The defense agencies only make money if an invasion does not occur, just as health insurance companies only make money when you are not sick, but rather well. Thus, the question that I would be most keen to answer if I were running a defense agency is, how can I best prevent an invasion? Let us assume that the French stateless society is a beacon of liberation in a sea of aggressive and statist nations. The French defense agencies would work day and night to ensure that the costs of invasion were as high as possible and the benefits as low as possible. Were I running one of these agencies, I would think of solutions along the lines of the following. Deactivated money. If I were concerned that my subscribers might be robbed by an invading army, I would offer reduced rates to those willing to allow their electronic money to be secured so that it could not be spent without their own thumbprint or something like that. Naturally, any system can be hacked, and people can be kidnapped along with their money, but the purpose here is not to prevent all possible workarounds, but rather to simply reduce the material benefits of invading France. Similarly, I might offer reduced defense rates to manufacturers that would be willing to allow a small GPS to be installed in the guts of their machinery, so that if it were removed to another country, it would no longer work. This device could also be included in cars and other items of value, so that they would either have to be used in France or they could not be used at all. Given that the control of bridges is a primary military objective, in order to facilitate the movement of troops and vehicles, I would also encourage the installation of particular devices in domestic cars and trucks, which would automatically keep access to bridges open. Thus, invading armies would find their access to these bridges much harder, which would again slow down the speed of their invasion. Furthermore, if invasion seemed imminent, I would arm and train as many citizens as possible. Any invading army would face a quite different challenge in a stateless society. If Germany invades Poland, how many citizens would risk their lives fighting against just another government? Whether a Polish leader taxes you or a German one makes relatively little difference, which is why your average citizen does not care much about who runs the local mafia. Citizens of a stateless society, however, would be resisting an attempt to inflict taxation and a government upon them, and so would be far more willing to fight the kind of endlessly draining insurgencies that we see so often in the annals of occupation. These are just a few admittedly off-the-cuff ideas, but it is relatively easy to see how the benefits of invading France could be significantly diminished or even eliminated, while the costs of invading France could be significantly increased or made prohibitive. The objection could be raised that some lunatic group could simply detonate a nuclear bomb somewhere inside France for some insane or nefarious motive. But that is not an argument against private defense agencies and for a statist society, but rather quite the reverse. The nuclear madman argument is not solved by the existence of a government, since no government can protect against this eventuality. However, a free society would be far less likely to be the target of such an attack, since it would have a defensive military policy only and not an aggressive and interventionist foreign policy, and thus would be infinitely less likely to provoke such a mad and genocidal retaliation. Switzerland, for instance, faces no real danger of having airplanes flown into buildings. It is my belief that, over time, the need for these proactive and defensive strategies would diminish, since the only thing that would ever really be needed is a few nuclear weapons as a deterrent, and even the need for these would diminish over time, since either the world itself would become stateless, thus eliminating the danger of war, or the statist societies would continue to attack each other only, for the reasons mentioned above, and the need to continually defend a stateless society would diminish. Finally, let's look at some of the illusions that we have about statist, quote, protection in history, as an example of how we can critically evaluate an example of a statist function. Statist national, quote, defense, a critical example. Briefly put, national defense is the need for a government to protect citizens from aggression by other governments. This is an interesting paradox, even beyond the obvious one of using a government to protect us from governments. If you were able to run a magic survey throughout history, which government do you think people would be most frightened of and enslaved by? Would it be A, their local state or lord, or B, some state or lord in some other country? What about ancient Rome? Would it be the local rulers who forced young Romans into military service for 20 years or more? Or the Carthaginians? What about England in the Middle Ages? Were the peasants more alarmed by the crushing taxation and strangling mobility restrictions imposed by their local lord? Or was the King of France their primary concern? Let us stop in Russia during the 18th century and ask the serfs, are you more frightened of the Tsar's soldiers or the German Kaiser? Let us go to a U.S. citizen of today and demand to know, are you more frightened of foreign invaders taking over Washington or of the fact that if you don't pay half your income in taxes, your own government will throw you in jail? Of course, we have to look at the Second World War, which has had more propaganda thrown at it than any other single conflict. Didn't the British government save the country from Germany? Well, that's an interesting question. The British government got into World War I, helped impose the brutal Treaty of Versailles, and then contributed to the boom and bust cycle of the 1920s, which destroyed the German middle class and aided Hitler's rise to power. During the 1930s, the British government supported the growing aggression of Hitler through subsidies, loans, and mealy-mouthed appeasement. Then, when everything had failed, it threw the bodies of thousands of young men at the German Air Force in the Battle of Britain. Finally, it caused the deaths of hundreds of thousands more British citizens and soldiers by defending Africa and invading France, rather than let Nazism collapse on its own, as it was bound to do, just as every tyranny has done throughout history. Can it really be said, then, that the British government protected its citizens throughout the first half of the 20th century? Millions killed, families shattered, the economy destroyed, half of Europe lost to Stalin and China to Mao. Can we consider that a great success? I think not. Only states win wars, never citizens. The fact of the matter is that we do not face threats to our lives and property from foreign governments, but rather from our own. The state will tell us that it must exist, at the very least, to protect us from foreign governments. But that is morally equivalent to the local mafia don telling us that we have to pay him 50% of our income so that he can protect us from the mafia in Paraguay. Are we given the choice to buy a gun and defend ourselves? Of course not. Who endangers us more, the local mafia guy or some guy in Paraguay we have never met that our local mafia guy says just might want a piece of us? I know which chance I would take. There is a tried and true method for resisting foreign occupation, which does not require any government, which we can see being played out in our daily news. During the recent invasion, the U.S. completely destroyed the Iraqi government and now has total control over the people and infrastructure. And what is happening? They are being attacked and harried until they will just have to get out of the country, just as they had to do in Korea and Vietnam, and just as the USSR had to do in Afghanistan. The Iraqi insurgents do not have a government at all, any more than the Afghani fighters did in the 1980s. Let's look at the Iraqi conflict in a slightly different light. America was attacked on 9/11 because the American government had troops in Saudi Arabia, and because it caused the deaths of hundreds of thousands of Iraqis during the bombing campaign of the 1990s. Given that the U.S. government provoked the attack, how well were the innocent victims of 9/11 protected by their government? even if we do not count the physical casualties of the war, given the massive national debt being run up to pay for the Iraq war, how well is the property of American citizens being protected? How much power would Bush have to wage war if he did not have the power to steal almost half the wealth of the entire country? The government does not need taxes in order to wage war. It wages war because it already has the power of taxation. And it uses the war to raise taxes, either on the current citizens through increases and inflation, or on future citizens through deficits. This simple fact helps explain why there were almost no wars in Western Europe from the end of the Napoleonic Wars in 1815 to the start of World War I in 1914. This was largely because governments could not afford wars. Ah, but then they all got their very own central banks and were able to pave the bloody path to the Great War with printed money and deficit financing. World War I resulted from an increase in state power, and in turn swelled state power and set the stage for the next war. Thus, the idea that we need to give governments the power to tax us in order to protect us is ludicrous, because it is taxation that gives governments the power to wage war. For pacifist countries, this war may be a war on poverty, or illiteracy, or drugs, or for universal health care, or whatever. It doesn't matter. The moment a government takes the power and moral right to forcibly take money from citizens, the stage is set for the ever-growing power of the state. The question then arises, how does a citizen keep his property and person safe? The first answer that I would give is another question, which is, which sector does more to protect you and your property, the public or the private? Let's look at the security mechanisms the private sector has introduced in just the past few decades. ATMs and credit cards, less need to carry cash. Cell phones can always call for help. Call display virtually eliminates harassing phone calls. Sophisticated home security systems, ID tracking tags, credit card numeric security, pepper spray, GPS, security cameras, anti-shoplifting devices, secure online transactions, and much more. What has the public sector done? Well, they shoot harmless drug users and seize their property. They will shoot you, too, if you don't pay the massive tax increases they demand. The police are virtually useless in property crimes, and many violent criminals are turned loose because the courts are too slow, or are put in house arrest because the prisons are too full of non-violent offenders. So, who has helped you secure your person and property over the last few decades? Your government, or your friendly local entrepreneurs? Those who have stepped in to protect you, or those who have doubled your taxes while letting criminals walk free? Have capitalist companies enraged foreigners to the point of terrorism? Of course not. The 9/11 terrorists attacked the World Trade Center to protest the financing of the U.S. government, the Pentagon, and the White House. They didn't go for a Ford Motor Plant or an Apple Store, and why would they? No one kills for iPhones. They kill to protest military power, which rests on public financing. In summation, then, it makes about as much sense to rely on governments for security as it does to rely on the mafia for protection. The mafia is really just protecting you from itself, as are all governments. Any man who comes up to you and says, I need to threaten your person and steal your property in order to protect your person and property, is obviously either deranged or not particularly interested, to say the least, in protecting your person and property. As long as we keep falling for the same old lies, we will forever be robbed blind for the sake of our supposed property rights and sent to wage war against internal or external enemies, so that those in power can further pick the pockets of those we leave behind. Part 2. Reasoning. Introduction. The 6 questions. When considering statist objections to anarchic solutions, the 6 questions below are most useful. Question number 1. Does the government actually solve the problem in question? Well, people often say that government courts solve the problem of injustice. However, these courts can take many years to render a verdict and cost the plaintiff and defendant hundreds of thousands of dollars or more. Government courts are also used to harass and intimidate, creating a chilling effect for unpopular opinions or groups. Thus, I find it essential to question the embedded premises of statism. Do state armies actually defend citizens? Does state policing actually protect private property? Does state welfare actually solve the problem of poverty? Does the war on drugs actually solve the problem of addiction and crime? Do state prisons actually rehabilitate prisoners and reduce crime? It can be very tempting to fall into the trap of thinking that the existing statist approach is actually a solution, but I try to avoid taking that for granted, since it is so rarely the case. Question number 2. Can the criticism of the anarchic solution be equally applied to the statist solution? One of the most common objections to a stateless society is the fear that a political monopoly could somehow emerge from a free market of competing justice agencies. In other words, anarchism is rejected because it contains the mere possibility of political monopoly. However, if political monopoly is such a terrible evil, then a statist society, which is founded on just such a political monopoly, must be rejected even more firmly, just as we would always choose the mere possibility of cancer over actually having cancer. Question number 3. Is anarchy accepted as a core value in non-political spheres? In my last book, Everyday Anarchy, I pointed out the numerous spheres in society where anarchy is both valued and defended, such as dating, career choices, education, and so on. If anarchy is dismissed as bad overall, then it also must be bad in these other spheres as well. Unless the person criticizing anarchy is willing to advocate for a ministry of dating, the value of anarchy in certain spheres must at least be recognized. Thus, anarchy cannot be rejected as an overall negative, and its admitted value and productivity must at least be accepted as potentially valid in other spheres as well. Question number 4. Would the person advocating statism perform state functions himself? Most of us recognize and accept the right to use violence in an extremity of self-defense. Those who support statism recognize that in this realm, state police merely formalize a right that everyone already has, namely, the right of self-defense. A policeman can use force to protect a citizen from being attacked, just as that citizen can use force himself. However, if someone argues that it is moral to use force to take money from people to pay for public schools, would he be willing to use this force himself? Would he be willing to go door to door with a gun to extract money for public schools? Would he be willing to extend this right to everyone in society? If not, then he has created two opposing ethical categories: the state police, to whom this use of violence is moral, and everyone else, to whom this use of violence is immoral. How can these opposing moral categories be justified? Question number 5. Can something be both voluntary and coercive at the same time? Everyone recognizes that an act cannot be both rape and lovemaking simultaneously. Rape requires force because the victim is unwilling. Lovemaking does not. Because no action can be both voluntary and coercive at the same time, statists cannot appeal to the principle of voluntarism when defending the violence of the state. Statists cannot say that we agree to be taxed and then say that taxation must be coercive. If we agree to taxation, the coercion is unnecessary. If we do not agree to taxation, then we are coerced against our will. Question number 6. Does political organization change human nature? If people care enough about the poor to vote for state welfare programs, then they will care enough about the poor to fund private charities. If people care enough about the uneducated to vote for state schools, they will care enough to donate to private schools. Removing the state does not fundamentally alter human nature. The benevolence and wisdom that democracy relies on will not be magically transformed into cold selfishness the moment that the state ends. Statism relies on maturity and benevolence on the part of the voters, the politicians, and government workers. If this maturity and benevolence is not present, the state is a mere brutal tyranny and must be abolished. If the majority of people are mature and benevolent, as I believe, then the state is an unnecessary overhead and far too prone to violent injustices to be allowed to continue. In other words, people cannot be called virtuous only when it serves the statist argument, and then selfish when it does not. There are another of other principles, which are more specific to particular circumstances, but the 6 described above will show up repeatedly. We will now take a quick tour through an overview of anarchism and sketch in broad strokes the beginnings of our solutions to the horrors of worldwide violence. Anarchism. Frequently asked questions. Isn't anarchism bad? Unfortunately, the term has been degraded through mythology to mean a world without rules, usually garbed in post-apocalyptic outerwear and riding a well-armed motorbike. This is nonsense, of course. Anarchy is merely the logically consistent application of the moral premise that the initiation of the use of force is wrong. If violence is a bad way to solve problems, then the government is by definition immoral, since government always means a group of individuals who claim the right to initiate violence against everyone else in the form of taxation, regulations, etc. But if there is no government, how can the inevitable conflicts in human society be resolved? The most important thing in philosophy is to consistently question the premises of propositions. For instance, embedded in the above argument is the premise that conflicts within human society are currently being resolved by governments. This is pure nonsense. Governments are agencies of force. Governments do not persuade. Governments do not reason. Governments do not motivate. Governments do not encourage. Governments do not resolve disputes. Governments have no more power to create morality than rape has to create love. A gun is only useful in self-defense. It cannot be used to create virtue. For somebody who is an anarchist, you sure do sound like a politician. Wasn't that just a complete dodge of the question? Ah, excellent catch. Well, here is as good a place as any to introduce you to the concept of dispute resolution organizations, or DROs. This concept cannot answer every conceivable question you might have about dispute resolutions within a stateless society, but rather is a framework for understanding the methodology of dispute resolution. Just as the scientific method cannot answer every possible question about the natural world, but rather points towards a methodology that allows these questions to be answered in a rational manner. DROs are companies that specialize in ensuring contracts between individuals and resolving any disputes that might arise. For instance, if I borrow $1,000 from you, I may have to pay $10 to a DRO to insure my loan. If I fail to pay you back your money, the DRO will pay you instead. Obviously, as my credit rating improves, the cost of insuring my contracts will decline. The DRO theory can be as complex as any other free market theory, and a lot of intellectual effort has gone into resolving how particular transactions might occur, such as multi-million dollar international contracts. Credible DRO theories have also been advanced that solve problems ranging from abortion to child abuse to murder to pollution. For more on DRO theory and practice, please see The Stateless Society, An Examination of Alternatives, below. But what about the roads? The most important thing to understand about anarchism is that it is a moral theory which cannot be logically judged by consequences alone. For instance, the abolition of slavery was a moral imperative because slavery, as an institution, is innately evil. The abolition of slavery was not conditional upon the provision of jobs for every freed slave. In a similar manner, anarchic theory does not have to explain how every conceivable social, legal, or economic transaction could occur in the absence of a coercive government. What is important to understand is that the initiation of the use of force is a moral evil. With that in mind, we can approach the problem of roads more clearly. First of all, roads are currently funded through the initiation of force. If you do not pay the taxes which support road construction, you will get a stern letter from the government, followed by a court date, followed by policemen coming to your house if you do not appear and submit to the court's judgment. If you use force to defend yourself against the policemen who are breaking into your home, you will very likely be shot down. The roads, in other words, are built at the point of a gun. The use of violence is the central issue, not what might potentially happen in the absence of violence. That having been said, roads will be built by housing developers, mall builders, those constructing schools and towns, just as they were before governments took them over in the 19th century. For more on this, please see the section on roads below. Okay, here's a scenario for you. A guy builds a road that completely encircles a suburban neighborhood and then charges $1 million for anyone to cross that road. Isn't he holding everyone who lives in that neighborhood hostage? This is fundamentally impossible. First of all, no one is going to buy a house in a neighborhood unless they are contractually guaranteed access to roads. Thus, it will be impossible for anyone to completely encircle the neighborhood. Secondly, even if it were possible, it would be a highly risky investment. Can you imagine going to investors with a business plan that said, I'm going to try and buy all the land that surrounds the neighborhood, see, and then charge exorbitant rates for anyone to cross that land? No sane investor would give you the money for such a plan. The risk of failure would be too great, and no DRO would enforce any contract that was so destructive, unpopular, and economically unfeasible. DROs, unlike governments, must be appealing to the general population. If a DRO got involved with the encircling and imprisonment of a neighborhood, it would become so unpopular that it would lose far more business than it could potentially gain. All right, smarty pants, what about this? The company that supplies water to a neighborhood suddenly decides to increase its rates tenfold. People are going to be forced to pay the exorbitant price, right? Now, first of all, if you were so concerned about people paying increasingly exorbitant prices for services, then it scarcely seems logical to propose the government as the solution to that problem. Taxes have risen immensely over the past 30 years, while services have declined. However, even if we accept the premise of the problem, it is easily solved in a stateless society. First of all, no one will buy a house in a neighborhood without a contractual obligation that requires the supply of water at reasonable rates. Secondly, if the water company starts charging exorbitant prices, another company will simply move in and supply water in another form, in barrels, bottles, or whatever. Thus, raising prices permanently costs the water company its customers and makes every potential customer back away for fear that the same predation will happen to them. Investors will quickly realize that the water company is shooting itself in the foot and will align themselves with other shareholders, resulting in a takeover of the price-gouging water company and a reduction in rates, followed by rank apologies and base groveling. Given that this result will be known in advance, no CEO would be allowed to pursue such a self-destructive course. Only governments that can be manipulated by corporations to prevent competition truly endanger customers. Okay, what if two DROs have different rules? Isn't that just going to result in endless civil war? First of all, it is unlikely that DROs would have wildly different rules because that would be economically inefficient. Cell phone companies use similar protocols so that they can interoperate with each other. Railroad companies tend to use the same gauge so that trains can travel as widely as possible. Internet service providers exchange data with other service providers, passing emails and other data back and forth. Like evolution, the free market is more about cooperation than pure competition. If a DRO wants to create a new rule, that rule will be fairly useless unless other DROs are willing to cooperate with it, just as a new email program is fairly useless unless it uses existing protocols. This need for interoperability with other DROs will inevitably keep the number of new rules to the most economically efficient minimum. Customers will prefer DROs with broader reciprocity agreements, just as they prefer credit cards that are valid in a large number of locations. New rules will also add to the costs for DRO subscribers, and if it costs them more money than it saves, the DRO will lose business. But won't the most successful DRO just arm itself, violently eliminate all the other DROs, and emerge as a new government? First of all, if the potential emergence of a new government at some point in the future is of great concern, then surely the elimination of existing governments in the present is a worthy goal. If we have cancer, we go through chemotherapy to eliminate it in the present, even though we may get cancer again at some point in the future. Secondly, unlike governments, DROs are not violent institutions. DROs will be primarily populated by white-collar workers, accountants, mediators, executives, and so on. DROs are about as likely to become paramilitary organizations as your average accounting firm is likely to become an elite squad of ninja death warriors. Given the current existence of governments that possess nuclear weapons, I for one am willing to take that risk. Thirdly, if a DRO tries to turn itself into a government, the other DROs will certainly act to prevent it. DROs would simply refuse to cooperate with any DRO that refused to submit to arms inspections. Furthermore, DRO customers would also not take very kindly to their DRO becoming an armed institution, and their rates would certainly skyrocket because their DRO would have to provide its regular services as well as pay for all those black helicopters and RPGs. Any DRO that was paying for goods or services that its customers did not want, i.e. an army, would very quickly go out of business because it would not be competitive in terms of rates. For more on this, please see War, Profit, and the State below. Are there any examples of anarchic societies being successful in the past? There are, but that is not the essential question. Again, the essential aspect of anarchic theory is the moral rule banning the initiation of the use of force. Anarchists advocate a stateless society because governments are evil. When slavery was abolished for the first time in human history, there was no prior example of a successful slave-free society. If that had been a requirement, then slavery would be with us still. That having been said, I can confidently point you towards a non-violent society that you're intimately aware of. You. I'm guessing that you do not use violence directly to achieve your aims. It seems likely to me that you did not hold your employer hostage until you got your job. I also doubt that you keep your spouse locked in the basement, or that you threaten to shoot your friends if they do not join you on the dance floor. In other words, you are the perfect example of a stateless society. All of your personal relationships are voluntary and do not involve the use of force. You are an anarchic microcosm. To see how a stateless society works, all you have to do is look in the mirror. How can a society without a government pay for national defense? Many people, when first hearing the concept of a stateless society, cannot imagine how collective defense could possibly be paid for in the absence of taxation. I have already briefly discussed this above. Here are some more details. This is an important question to ask, but there is a way of answering it that also answers many other questions about collective action. In any society, there are four possibilities that can occur in the realm of collective defense. The first is that no one wants to pay for collective defense. The second is that only a minority of people want to pay for collective defense. The third is that the majority of people want to pay for collective defense. And the fourth is that everyone wants to pay for collective defense. Let's compare how these four possibilities play out in a state-based democracy. 1. No one wants to pay for collective defense. In this case, voters will universally reject any politician who proposes collective defense of any kind. 2. Only a minority of people want to pay for collective defense. In this case, no politician who proposes paying for collective defense will ever get into office because he will never secure a majority of the votes. 3. The majority of people want to pay for collective defense. In this case, pro-defense politicians will be voted into office and spend tax money on defense. 4. Everyone wants to pay for collective defense. This achieves the same outcome as number 3. Thus, all other things being equal, a democracy produces almost the same outcome as a stateless society, with the important exception of number 2. If only a minority of people want to pay for defense, they cannot do so in a democracy, but can do so in a stateless society. In a stateless society, if the majority of people are interested in paying for collective defense, it will be paid for. The addition of the government to the interaction is entirely superfluous, the equivalent of creating a ministry devoted to communicating the pleasures of candy to children or sex to teenagers. However, the possibility exists that people are willing to pay for collective defense only if they know that everyone else is paying for it as well. This argument fails on multiple levels, both empirical and rational. 1. People tip waiters and give to charity even though they know that some people never do. 2. There is no reason why, in a stateless society, people should not have full knowledge of who has donated to collective defense. Agencies providing collective defense could easily issue a donor card, which certain shops or employers might ask to see before doing business. Names of donors could also be put on a website, easily searchable, creating social pressures to donate. 3. When the money required for collective defense is stripped from taxpayers at the point of a gun, a basic moral tenet and rational criterion is violated. Citizens institute collective defense in order to protect their property. It makes no sense whatsoever to create an agency to protect property rights and then invest that agency with the power to violate property rights at will. 4. When collective defense is paid for by the initiation of the use of force, there is no rational ceiling to costs and no incentive for efficiency, thus ensuring that costs will escalate to the point where they become unsustainable, causing a collapse of the economic system and leaving the country vulnerable. What about education? Well, the question of education follows the same pattern as the question of collective defense outlined above. However, there are certain additional pieces of information that can strengthen the case for a free market in education. First of all, it is important to understand that state education was not imposed because children were not being educated. Prior to the institution of government-run education, the functional literacy rate of the average American was over 90%. Far better than it is now, after hundreds of billions of dollars have been spent, quote, educating children. Before the government forcefully took over the schools, there was almost no violence in schools. There were no school shootings, no violent gangs, no assaults on teachers. And it did not take more than 2 decades and hundreds of thousands of dollars to produce a reasonably educated adult. Most of the intellectual giants of the 18th and 19th centuries, the founding fathers included, did not even finish high school, let alone go to college. Government education in America was instituted as a means of cultural control due to rising tribal fears about the growing numbers of non-Protestants in society, the immigrant issue of the time. There are a number of core reasons that government education cripples children's minds. For the sake of brevity, we will deal with only one here. It is reasonable to assume that the majority of parents want to give their children a good education. And this education must necessarily include the teaching of values, or the relationship between personal ethics and real-world choices. In any multicultural society, however, a common curriculum cannot include any fundamental values for fear of offending various groups. Thus, values must be stripped from education, turning its focus to rote memorization, bland technical skills, geometry, sports, woodshop, and neutral and propagandistic views of society and politics. Democracy is good. Respect multiculturalism. Reduce, reuse, recycle. This effectively kills the energetic curiosity of the young, turns school into a mind-numbing series of empty exercises, creates frustration among those needing stimulation, and engenders deep disrespect for the educational system and its teachers, who remain institutionally indifferent to the welfare of the students. Combine this hostility and frustration with the easy money available through drug sales and the possibility of surviving on welfare, and entire generations of youths become mentally crippled. The costs of this are beyond calculation, since the damage goes far beyond economics. Yes, but how will poor children get an education if it is not paid for through taxes? This reminds me of the old Soviet cartoon. Two old women are standing in an endless lineup to buy bread. One says to the other, "Oh, what a terribly long line." The other replies, "Yes, but just imagine, in the capitalist countries, the government doesn't even distribute the bread." Whenever I argue for a stateless society, I say, "The government should not provide X." The response always comes back, "But how will X then be provided?" As mentioned above, the answer is simple. Since everyone is concerned that X will not be provided, X will naturally be provided by those who are concerned by its absence. In other words, since everyone is concerned that poor children might not get an education,